This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Library Science Channel of New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I'm speaking with Rose Myron, author of Indigenous Archival Activism, Mohican Interventions in Public History and Memory, published by the University of Minnesota Press in April 2024. Tracing one tribe's 50-year fight to recover and rewrite its history, Indigenous archival activism takes readers into the heart of debates over who owns and has the right to tell Native American history and stories. Rose Myron explores how the work of the Stockbridge Munsee Mohican Nation and its historical committee is exemplary of how tribal archives can strategically shift how Native history is accessed, represented, written, and most important, controlled. Rose Myron is director of the Darcy McNichol Center for American Indian and Indigenous Studies at the Newberry Library. Rose, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
And before we jump into talking about your new book, I was wondering if you could maybe introduce yourself to listeners, maybe share a little bit about your own background as a historian and also your relationship with the Stockbridge Munsee Historical Project and the historical committee there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, just thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan of this podcast, so it's just a joy to be here. So I'm a non-Native historian. I grew up in northeastern Wisconsin, and I have been interested in history for as long as I could remember. For a long time, I thought that I would be a high school history teacher, and that's what I initially went to school for with getting my BA in history. But I was an undergraduate. I had the opportunity to participate in a program at the University of Minnesota that allows undergraduates to conduct research with a faculty member. And I had the pleasure of being connected with Jean O'Brien, who is a White Earth Ojibwe historian at the University of Minnesota. And I was taking an American and Indigenous Studies class at the time. And she encouraged me to find something that I was interested in and get a little bit of experience doing more primary source research. And so I was introduced to this oral history project that the Stockbridge Munsee Mohican Nation was on at the time, called Here Are Stories. And so I, at that point, started working a little bit with the tribe. I went to a public viewing of one of the oral histories, an event that they had on the reservation, and started speaking to people and said that, you know, I was interested in maybe writing about this a little bit. And at that point was encouraged by the folks who were working at the Library Museum at that time to take a look at the tribal archive. You know, they were very clear right away that this was really just a piece of this much larger thing, and that I should take a look at the archive, come to a historical committee meeting, learn a little bit more about what they were working on. So I did that. I ended up writing my undergraduate thesis on this oral history project, which ultimately became the second chapter of the book. And then, you know, between conversations with Jeannie and conversations with the community, Jeannie was like, you should really think about going to graduate school for history. And I was like, what's that? Like, what does that mean? And what does it look like? And in talking with the community about it, we talked about the possibility of creating more of a longer story about the historical committee. You know, as I got into the tribal archive a little bit more, it became very clear to me that this oral history project was just really one piece of a much larger historical recovery project. And so we talked about, you know, what would be the merits of creating a longer history that really tells that story. And the historical committee was really interested in it. And so I decided to apply to graduate school and ultimately then got my PhD from the University of Minnesota as well as, and that's where I did my undergraduate as well. So that I started working with the tribe in 2010 was when the first oral histories were published and when I started viewing them and working with community members. And then, you know, over the next 14 years, we worked together to really figure out how to tell this story and figure what this book should look like. You know, this was really an iterative process. It involved a lot of me driving back and forth between Minneapolis and the reservation, or, you know, in northeastern Wisconsin, where I grew up in the reservation. I grew up about an hour away from it. And it just really involved us figuring out, you know, what should be the stories that are told, what should this include. It included a lot of review of drafts of both the dissertation and ultimately the book, and making sure to compensate people for their time in reading those materials. And then ultimately, you know, I think we tried to create a project that was supportive of the historical committee and of the tribe's priorities overall. You know, so one of the things that we made sure as I was like going through the process of getting a book project was that all the royalties from the book were going to go to the tribe and specifically to support the creation of a new cultural center. You know, we throughout my research process, we talked about like where I was traveling and if there were other collections that the tribe hadn't had a chance to see yet that I would make copies of and bring back. And I'm still engaged in doing some of that work, you know, right now, even though the book is out now. So I think we've just really built what I see as a historical relationship and worked collaboratively to think about how to tell this story in a good way and in a way that really attends to community priorities and really centers community voices.
Super. Thank you so much. And so, I mean, I'm really inspired by your mention that work you did as an undergraduate made it into this book as the second chapter. I think we never really feel like the work we did as an undergraduate will ever see the light of day. And that's pretty exciting. Yeah. So thinking then about where the book starts, there's this question that you have at the start. How can the nation building processes that we've seen colonial nation states use archives for be different when the nations and archives in question are those of sovereign indigenous nations? So thinking specifically about how the historical committee and the tribal archive, the Stockbridge Munsee Historical Project was formed, can you describe a little bit that initial creation of the project and how it's evolved since its founding?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I think it's really important to start by saying that Mohican people have been recording and relaying their history since time immemorial. You know, the book largely focuses on this period from 1968 to the present, which is 1968 is when the historical committee was founded. But this process isn't new. This is something that early leaders like Hendrik Oppenpot and John Quinney recorded in the writings that they were publishing in, you know, the 18th and 19th centuries. And they talked about this long process of the history of the community being kind of carried by somebody who was named as a recorder or a rememberer, and how that person would relay this to future generations and these stories would be passed along. That was continued later in the 20th century with people like Carter and Elmer Davids, who are the respective fathers of Arvid and Bernice, who are the kind of two people that I start the story with. Arvid Miller and Bernice Davids, later Miller, were married in 1935. And it was really around that time that the tribe as a whole had a need for not only just relaying stories through people, but a physical archive. This was the moment when the Indian Reorganization Act was passed and the tribe was having to gather lots of historical materials, you know, maps, all of these sorts of things to essentially make an argument to the government that they were indeed a tribal nation and that they should be able to have their own tribal government. And so as they were doing all of that work, they needed a place to store these materials and they needed people to collect them, basically. And so Arvid and Bernice really took on that role starting in the 1930s. And between 1930 and 1968, the archive was in their home. And Arvid was tribal councilman for, was the tribal chairman, excuse me, for much of that time. So he actually would travel to archives across the United States as part of his, like, his role as a tribal chairman. Like, if he was going out to Washington, D.C., he would go to the National Archives and he would go to these different places and he would copy these materials by hand. This was, you know, before scanners existed. And so he would, a lot of the early archival materials are his handwritten transcriptions of these early archival materials. Arvid passed away in 1968. And in that same year, there was an unrelated fire in Bernice Miller's home. And neighbors actually went into the burning structure and pulled out all of these archival materials, saving them. And it was at that moment that Bernice and her sister, Dorothy Davids, and some of the other women in the community kind of came together and said, okay, you know, we need to do something with these materials. Arvid and Bernice had long dreamed of creating a formal tribal library and archive. And so the fire was sort of the literal spark that that made them want to really transition this into a formal project. And so these women got together and they started making a plan. You know, they listed out all of the other archives that they wanted to visit, continuing Arvid's work of, you know, gathering materials. But at the same time, we really see this kind of multi-pronged approach that they take. You know, they talk about the importance of reorganizing the materials that are coming in so that community members can access them. They're prioritizing conducting oral histories because they recognize that, you know, these documents can only tell us so much. And they start to plan external programs, both for the community and for schools, especially to try to change representations of their history. So the committee goes on to lead and support just an incredibly wide range of activities, you know, ranging from like things like on-reservation language revitalization to trips to their homelands out on the East Coast, to education curriculums, and then more kind of true publicity things like walking tours and museum exhibits. At times, they have worked with the Language and Culture Committee, as well as more recently, the Department of Cultural Affairs, which was formed by the tribe in 2018, and sort of combined archival, historical preservation, and language efforts, and now has several paid staff positions.
So. Yeah, that's like really impressive how the project has come along and developed. And another thing that you note in the introduction of this book, and I was thinking about this while you were talking at the start of our conversation about like the reciprocal nature of your work on this project, you pointed out in the book that as a researcher in this area, you're working in a context that historically has been the space of exploitation and misrepresentation. And so then in chapter two, you're focusing on specifically how the Mohican Tribal Archive was working, really intentionally working against that misrepresentation, expanding itself through oral histories. So could you talk a little bit more about why those were initiated, how they were conducted, and really how they were imagined as a way to shift traditional power dynamics that we often see in oral histories? And I'm curious if you're willing to talk about how you took precautions around your own involvement in the oral histories so that you weren't contributing to these like settler colonial practices that typically do more harm.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with the oral history projects that the tribe initiated. As I mentioned before, oral histories were something that like show up in the early lists of like priorities that community members were creating in the 1970s. And they start conducting interviews almost right away. And these were really initiated because community members understood that even though they were very interested in collecting these colonial documents that were coming from all of these archives across the country, those documents were limited in what they could tell us about Stockbridge Munsee Mohican people. A lot of them are written from the perspective of white settlers who were interacting with indigenous people. You know, they don't get at a lot of the lived experience of indigenous people or the emotions that people were experiencing in these historical events. And that's not to say that the people who were being interviewed were firsthand that they encountered like, or that they experienced these like, you know, 17th and 18th century events firsthand, but those stories passed on through generations. And you see in the oral interviews that the community conducted that people talk about how their ancestors experienced some of these historical events. And, you know, I think that that is still extremely valuable information when we think about studying these historical things. So the committee understood that. They understood that there were gaps. There's also, I mean, the oral histories are also just an incredibly rich source for the 20th century. You know, you have a lot of people talk about their military experience, about their experience in the day school that was near the reservation, about their experiences during relocation, having to leave the reservation and go to cities with their families. So those are really rich firsthand accounts as well. In terms of just thinking about like the typical power dynamics of oral histories are very frequently conducted by people who are outside of whatever community that they are conducting those interviews with. And they're often being conducted for the purpose of like some kind of external project. And then they're often deposited in archives, often far away from the communities that were being interviewed. In fact, like typical best practices with oral histories often say that like oral historians should consider like a very public archive that is highly accessible to lots of people rather than prioritizing the needs of the community. And so these interviews conducted by the community and by the historical committee specifically were very different in that the project was initiated by the tribe. These were never meant, I mean, they're open to the public, but they were meant for an internal audience. They're meant for other tribal members. And the historical committee are the people doing the interviews. They're the people asking the questions. You know, they're doing things like giving tobacco at the beginning of an interview. They are able to respond to the stories that people are sharing in a real way. And you can really tell in the interviews how people talk, that they are talking to other tribal members. You know, they refer to things like, you know, oh, as you know, like this is where this thinks or something, you know, they reference things that would be familiar to other tribal members. So it's very clear that these were really meant for an internal audience and that, you know, the fact that they live in the Arvid E. Miller Library Museum now and that they are not, you know, online or anything like that, like you have to go to the reservation to them or to view them in the case of the video interviews. So they're really meant for a tribal audience, and that's very different from a typical oral history project where somebody is kind of coming in from the outside and doing it from for an some kind of external project. With all of that in mind, I was not planning on doing oral interviews for this. I just was kind of like, you know, there's so much power that goes into these. I didn't really feel like it was my place. And it wasn't really something that the historical committee and I had previously talked about until one meeting when they were like, so when are you doing oral interviews? And I was like, I wasn't planning on it. You know, this was not part of what we have discussed up to this point. And one of the women who was in that meeting was like, I think that if you just like read these archival documents and you don't actually talk to people, it's like looking at like ants on an anthill. Like she was just like, you're not going to really get this story unless you talk to people and unless you conduct these interviews. So it's at the request of the historical committee that I did that. And we worked really hard together to think about the interview questions. And we also worked with the legal department to create forms before I ever started conducting interviews that lay out right away that like I would be waiving my copyright and that the copyright would live with the tribe and that the interviews would be deposited in the Arvid E. Miller Library Museum. They're not going to be, you know, taken to some offsite repository where tribal members can't access them. So we were really intentional about creating that process and about thinking about what that looked like. And I will just say, you know, as the project went on, I also just learned that I kind of had to be flexible with how to talk to people. There were a lot of people who were interested in talking, but not interested in doing a formal recorded interview. And so ultimately, you know, I conducted a couple of formal recorded interviews and those transcripts and the recordings are in the Arvid E. Miller Library Museum, but there were a lot of other people who just wanted to have a phone conversation. And those people are cited throughout the book and quoted throughout the book, but they were not interested in having those conversations recorded. And I felt like, you know, those are not technically oral interviews, but I felt like it was still really important to include those voices and that knowledge. And it was really at the urging of the current director of cultural affairs, Dale, that I talked with a very wide range of people who had worked in a library museum, because, you know, she rightfully said, like, I think it's really important that people see themselves in this book. And so in order to do that, you know, you have to be flexible in how, like, not everybody is going to be interested in doing a formal recorded interview, and you have to be flexible in how you can include those voices. So I think we tried to do that together.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah, I feel like Man, we could have a whole other conversation about research methods and like being creative with research methods, but we will not do that today. But then looking at the, so this first half of the book has really been like examining the archive and the historical project and the historical committee. And then the second half of your book shifts to look at how the tribal archive has been a tool for changing the broader representation of Mohican history. There are so many amazing projects here. I know we will not talk about them all, so I really hope people get their hands on the book and read it. But could you describe some of the projects that you write about in chapters 3 and 4 and how the archive has really been used as a tool in these instances for Mohican nation building and self-determination?
The third chapter is really about projects that are for tribal audiences. So it is looks at how the tribal archive has been used by historical committee members and by others for things like language revitalization, cultural revitalization, land reclamation projects, kind of new publications that are being published by community members, and things like repatriation. So it shows really how the archive can be used as an essential tool in larger nation building efforts and larger efforts towards self-determination. Just to give one example of this, so that folks can kind of understand the kinds of way that the archive gets used in these projects. There's one particular kind of deep dive repatriation case that is talked about in the book about this 2-volume Bible set that was given to the tribe in 1745, stolen from the tribe in 1930, and then repatriated in 1991, just before the passage of NAGPRA. And it's quite a long story that we don't have time to go into on this podcast, but I'll just say that because the repatriation happened before NAGPRA, it was a multi-decade fight that the committee initiated to get these items back. And one of the main things that they used was materials from the tribal archive that showed that these items were stolen, that showed how important they were to community members. And they assembled all of these tribal documents in 2 different booklets, I guess you could say, that they circulated and used to create this like national letter writing campaign. So the first book is called A Brief History of the Stockbridge Bibles. It includes, you know, published works about Mohican history dating back to the 19th century. It includes letters from tribal members, as well as correspondence between the collector and the person who stole the Bibles from the community in the first place. And then there's a second set of documents called the Stockbridge Bible, documents relating to its recovery by the Stockbridge Indians. And this includes some additional firsthand accounts from the 19th and 20th century that talk about the care that the community extended towards these items, as well as the correspondence between the tribe and the museum. This fight for these materials was going on. And so these, like the very actual documents were circulated as a way to sort of make this argument for why these materials should come home. And, I think it's a great example of how these materials can be used in repatriation fights. And, you know, anybody who's ever worked with NAGPRA knows that even in formal NAGPRA cases, you have to have an astounding amount of documentation to prove tribal affiliation related to materials. As well as to make the case that the items were taken in some way. And so I think tribal archives in general can be very useful for those kinds of cases. Just to speak about the materials in these 2 booklets that the historical committee created, I mean, those materials came from probably at least 12 different archives. And if the tribal archive didn't exist at that point, historical committee members would have been, you know, traveling to multiple different locations across the eastern half of the United States, copying these materials, where because some of that work had already been done, they were able to put these things together relatively quickly and circulate them and ultimately successfully repatriate these items.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were, I mean, I really like that you brought up that example, because they published those booklets as part of that effort, but there were like other publication projects that they were doing too. And I love seeing archives resulting in generative projects like publications. And I love seeing publications used for like kind of self-determination and self-representation. So I thought that was, I think they had a newsletter and some things like that came out of the archive.
Yeah. The newsletter was one of the first things that the historical committee did after they were founded. And it's actually the first tribal newspaper for the Stockbridge Muncie Mohican Nation. And they used it to circulate like historical findings that they were encountering as they were processing these materials. And then ultimately it became the Tribal Newspaper and was renamed. And obviously the Tribal Newspaper covers many more things than historical findings now, but it was like the first publication that was circulated.
That's really great. And then thinking about, you know, these examples as sort of the inward facing projects of the archive, your fifth chapter looks like moves kind of, I guess, a little broader in how the projects are oriented, discussing Mohican interventions in public education. So how has the archive been really foundational for those kinds of projects? And what are some of the lessons we can take away from that work about the possibilities of archival activism?
Yeah, absolutely. As you asked me that question, I realized that I didn't talk about the fourth chapter in your question previously.
So
I'll jump back quick and then I will jump to the fifth chapter. I'll just kind of quickly say the fourth chapter, both the fourth and fifth chapters kind of turn to more external audiences, whereas the third one is more about tribal audiences. But the fourth chapter is, I will say, sort of the bridge in between those things, because the fourth chapter is about these historical trips that the historical committee coordinated back to Mohican homelands. So Stockbridge-Fronting Mohican people were removed from the East Coast. Their homelands are in the Mahicanatuck or the Hudson River Valley, and they were removed from that area over the course of seven different removals before ending up in central Wisconsin. And so starting in 1968, historical committee members start planning for fairly small trips initially to go back to the East Coast, particularly Stockbridge, Massachusetts, which is where the first part of the tribe's name comes from. This was a Mohican village, but was where they decided to accept a Christian mission is a kind of a big part of their tribal identity, because it's where a lot of the folks came together and then ultimately where they were removed from for their first removal into upstate New York. So the historical committee started planning these trips back initially to gather archival materials. But pretty quickly by the early 1970s, they started planning these larger group trips where they would take, you know, anywhere from initially maybe like 10 people to ultimately like dozens of people on like coach buses, to the East Coast to do basically, you know, place-based teaching tribal history. And historical committees were, again, using the tribal archive to create these itineraries, to research different places that they would take people. And it became a way to educate tribal members about their own history in these places, and also ultimately to, you know, cultivate a shared sense of collective memory. And that's really where I make the argument that this is ultimately about nation building. And this is ultimately about, you know, creating shared identities as a group of people with a shared history. But they're also doing things as they go out, like contacting newspapers, awareness of their presence, and, you know, very clearly push back against this Last of the Mohicans myth that comes from, you know, James Fenimore Cooper's very famous book and later movie. And so the trips, I would say, are both like inward and outward facing, in that they were certainly like about tribal members and educating tribal members and bringing people together and bringing people out to their homelands. But it ultimately enabled the tribe to position itself as the best experts on their own history. And ultimately it led to the creation of the Tribal Historic Preservation Office for the Stockbridge-Munsee Mohican Nation is now based on the East Coast at Williams College, actually. And it's been on the East Coast since 2015. So it really puts them in a position to do a lot of what I talk about in the fifth chapter, which is more like truly public facing projects. And so those projects range from things like, you know, walking tours to educational curriculum to museum exhibits. And again, like having archival materials at hand in a searchable repository just makes all of this work much faster when you are trying to, you know, put together a walking tour, you're trying to do archaeological research. Like having those materials at hand, it just makes things a lot easier. And that kind of primary source research is essential for really any of those projects. I think in terms of the lessons, I know that was something that you had asked, you know, I think the biggest lessons that I hope that people take from these projects is that, you know, first of all, that tribes are the best representatives of their own history. And that these archival materials are incomplete without their knowledge and interpretations. If you can't create a walking tour based on archival materials without talking to Stockbridge-Munsee people, and you can't do a museum exhibit about them without having community knowledge and without doing this collaboratively. And I hope that the projects that are in the fifth chapter really show that and show how important collaboration is and how much that community knowledge is really essential to interpreting these archival materials. The other thing I'll say is that like access to these archival materials is just incredibly challenging without some kind of central repository. But once those materials are accessible, tribes can make huge inroads in how their histories are represented when they do have access to those materials. And I hope that that's one of the things that, especially those of us who work in non-native archival repositories, take away and think about why it's so important to make these materials accessible. And, you know, just to, but I think, again, I hope that people just see how transformative the materials can be when they are available. I mean, just to like give one kind of example, in the case of the town of Stockbridge, I mean, the historical representation there has been like completely transformed. You know, you read these like journal accounts of historical committee members who were making trips there in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And they're talking about like, you know, these like blatantly racist things that they're encountering, these like terrible misrepresentations of Native people that are in these museums that they're visiting. And if you go there now, it's a completely different experience. You know, the museum that focuses on the Stockbridge Munsee people that used to have an area where children could like put on red face is now an exhibit that has been completely curated by the Department of Cultural Affairs. And it's all about repatriation and all about these, you know, collaborations and the importance of these lands to Stockbridge Munsee people. There's a walking tour that you can take through the main street of town that has video interviews with tribal members standing on the plots of lands that their ancestors were deeded and talking about what it means to them to return to these pieces of, and then like the, one of the sacred places for Mohican people, Monument Mountain, which is just outside of Stockbridge, the trails have been renamed to you know, celebrate Stockbridge Munsee history. And there's a great new, there's great new signage at the bottom of the mountain talking about this and talking about the importance of the mountain and like why it's named what it is. So I think, you know, all of those projects I really see as like coming out of the initial creation of the historical committee and the creation of the tribal archive. And this, you know, this very long process of recording and remembering and now recovering Stockbridge Munsee Mohican history.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've started to talk about this a little bit, but something that you really focus on towards the end of the book is that, yes, Indigenous political action and nation building is, you know, really using archives to shift how Native history is accessed and represented and taught and written, but also settler colonial institutions need to be doing this work and supporting this work. So how can these settler colonial institutions be guided by these same principles underlying the activism that Native groups are undertaking here? And how can settler colonial institutions work in collaboration with tribal nations?
Yeah, so in the beginning of the book, I lay out kind of three pillars for what I call Indigenous archival activism. And Indigenous archival activism is sort of encompasses like all of the work that we've been talking about, right? It's like the creation of the tribal archive, as well as the way that the archive has been mobilized for all of these different public projects. And the three pillars that I talk about are access, sovereignty, and new narratives. And this was actually something that came after this. Those three pillars were not in my dissertation. This was a framework that I came to after working at the Newberry, where I work now. And prior to working at the Newberry, I was on staff at the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition and doing a lot of work with the digital archive that they are working on, and trying to, you know, gather oral records in a way that would make them more accessible to survivors and descendants. And in both of those institutions, I found myself often using access and sovereignty as like kind of describing them as like the levers that non-Native institutions could pull in order to allow for the creation of new narratives that are generated by Native people, right? So if you make archival materials accessible in a way that people can use them to create new narratives, like there are going to be new narratives created by Native people. And that access has to happen through both like, you know, outreach, but also changing the way that like materials are organized and the way they're cataloged and like all of those sort of like nitty gritty things. But then I think that has to come with a respect for tribal sovereignty and recognizing that you know, the way that these archival materials were collected and the way that they are cataloged and organized now continues to be in a settler colonial framework. And so we have to work really hard to change that and to realign our internal policies with Indigenous protocols in a way that respects Indigenous knowledge and in a way that, you know, really puts Indigenous knowledge kind of on the same at the same place as like archival best practices, which I don't think has previously been the case. So I think that, you know, the conclusion of the book really encourages those of us who are working in settler colonial institutions to kind of think about those three tenets and think about what they can do to increase access and what they can do to align their internal policies with Indigenous protocols and in a way that respects Indigenous sovereignty. And really making the argument that if those two things happen, there will be more opportunities for Indigenous people to create new narratives of their history or for people to collaborate with Native people in a responsible and reciprocal way to create new narratives. So I think that, you know, when I talk to people about the work that's important in terms of collaborating with tribal nations, like, you know, it's a long process. Like I will say from the perspective of the Newberry, like we're nowhere close to being done with this work. And I don't think we will be done with this work in my lifetime. You know, the collection is massive and there's just a ton of work to do. But I think that you have to start somewhere. And I think starting with, you know, what policies you have on the books and thinking about how those can be shifted to be better alignment with Indigenous protocols is a great place to start. And then thinking about, you know, just like what responsibilities do you have given both the land that you're on and the items that are in your collection and going from there.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I guess, you know, to wrap up, reading this book really made me excited to learn what's next, both for the Historical Committee and the Tribal Archive and also for the work that you're doing. So I would love if you could share more about any upcoming projects or new research, either that you're working on as an individual or that the Historical Committee is undertaking. If you'd like to share how listeners can connect with the current work of the Tribal Archive, that'd be really terrific.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with the Sacramento speaking community. So I would really encourage folks to visit the tribe's website. You know, there's so much information on that website that is available to people. One of the publications that came out of some of this early archival work is this document called A Brief History, which is by Dorothy Davids, one of the founders of the Historical Committee. That's available as a PDF on the website. The Department of Cultural Affairs also has links to many of the projects that they're working on, as well as a resource guide and a fact sheet that I think are really, really useful resources. There are also several videos of tribal members talking about their own history that are linked within that resource guide. And I personally would especially recommend people checking out the Footprints of Our Ancestors walking tour. That's one of like my favorite projects that I wrote about in the book, and I just think it's amazing, and you can access the entire thing online. So, you know, if you happen to be in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, absolutely do it in person. But you can also access the entire walking tour online. And I would highly recommend folks look at that. Mohican Writers also just published a volume called Along the Many Trails, a journal of contemporary literature by Mohican people. You can buy that most places where books are sold. And so I would definitely encourage folks checking that out. That's probably one of the more recent projects that has happened. And then of course, you know, I always just have to make a plug that if you happen to be in Wisconsin, like go to the library museum, you know, it's open and they have amazing exhibits. And I would definitely encourage folks to look at that. In terms of my own work, so as I sort of hinted at before, we are continuing to work on Indigenous initiatives at the Newberry in working to bring our internal policies into alignment with, especially with the protocols for Native American archival materials, which is probably a document that a lot of listeners are familiar with. But this includes like an ongoing effort to identify culturally sensitive materials and apply TK labels to materials in accordance with tribal protocols, as well as to do like corrective cataloging practices to make materials more searchable and accessible. In terms of my own work, we are currently working at the Newberry on a public-facing project about the Indigenous history of Chicago. So that is what I have been working on really, you know, over the last 4 years. But is kind of my focus at the moment. So the project will be kind of a multi-pronged thing worked at or aimed at changing narratives of Indigenous history in Chicago. So there'll be an exhibition that's open at the Newbery in fall of 2024. There'll be a website with many digital mapping components, curriculum for 10th grade social studies, new oral histories with community members, and a series of public programs. And so that's really been a joy to work on. And it's being done in extensive collaboration with both community members in Chicago, as well as tribal representatives from tribes whose ancestral homelands include Chicago. So it's a shift, certainly, from working on what I worked on in the first book, but in many ways, it's a similar historical project in that it has kind of all of these different ways of getting at this history and trying to change the way that, in this case, the Indigenous history of Chicago is represented. So I'm busy working on that right now, and excited for the project to launch in the fall. And I haven't started a ton of this, but I'm sort of lightly interested in pursuing some kind of writing project that comes out of this. One of the things that I've noticed as we've been doing this work is just how warped the founding narratives of Chicago as a city are, in particular, just in the way that they're represented in monuments and the way that people talk about them, and how attached people are to kind of the founding myths that really erase and marginalize Indigenous people. I'm kind of interested in digging into that a little bit more as we've been doing a lot of the research for this project. I've come across a lot of like early materials that I think really need to be reread and reconsidered in different lights. And so we're kind of lightly thinking about pursuing the project, but it's too soon to say what it will be, if it will be an article or a book or what that will look like. But that's sort of what I'm thinking about right now.
That sounds great. Well, thank you for sharing all of this. Once again, today I've been speaking with Rose Myron, author of Indigenous Archival Activism, Mohican Interventions in Public History and Memory, published by the University of Minnesota Press. My name is Jen Hoyer, and this is New Books Network.